Good evening and welcome to Radio Edge Talk. My name is David Noble, this evening in Edinburgh, and I'm delighted to have on the show Terry Reekley, who's visiting professor at Leeds Metropolitan University. And for the next half hour or so, we're going to be talking about his new book, Living on the Edge, Rethinking Poverty, Class and Schooling. Welcome to Radio Edge Talk, Terry.
Hi, it's good to be here, David. Thank you for the invitation.
Great. And just to start off with, could you just give listeners a kind of brief background to your career in education and academia?
Okay, well, first of all, yes, I've got a visiting professorship in Leeds, but I'm a resident of Edinburgh and definitely a yes voter in September. I've worked as a teacher in secondary schools, secondary school English. I've worked in local government, running staff development in a local authority. I've even been a school inspector in the dreaded Ofsted system until I then got a proper job working at Moray House in teacher education. For 11 years, I took early retirement 4 years ago. Which is the point at which Leeds Met picked me up, and also my children in terms of my other role of being a granddad. So that's basically it. I guess that maybe the relevant bit of my background is that I come from an industrial area in the north of England. Parents both semi-skilled workers, I suppose, I've most of my teaching was and subsequent work has been in areas where there's been considerable deprivation and a struggle to improve pupils' opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a bit more about the book then, in terms of how it came about and why your colleagues felt it necessary to be
Well, it's the sixth book I've either written or been involved in as editor, and I felt for a long time that this is desperately needed writing, because the statistics show very strongly that there is a tendency for pupils coming from less skilled occupational backgrounds, and particularly now children growing up in poverty, there's a general tendency for them to achieve far lower in schools. But there's complete confusion as to the reasons why. And this has been an issue that's been clear in different ways for over a century, and different theories have become fashionable at various times. And I really wanted to get to grips with this issue. So along with John Smythe, my Australian collaborator on this, we dug back into the original arguments, and as well as looking at how they operate in the present day. We needed to sweep the stables clean in order to operate properly in this field. So in many ways it's not a book of tips for teachers, but it is a book of serious thinking, and we hope it's very readable. I think it's readable.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree. And I suppose briefly, can you take us through how the book is structured?
The first section is really a discussion of class and poverty as material realities, but also in terms of people's experience, and particularly in terms of the experience of children. And then we look at some of the major theories, the major arguments that have amounted to really blame the victim. Blame the victim for being supposedly of inferior intelligence and born that way. That was the big theory for many decades. Blame the victim for... blame the parents, the whole language deprivation argument. And more recently, these families have low aspirations. So, in other words, there's been a whole succession of writing off. So that's really the second major part of the book. And the next part is really the more recent fashion of blame the teachers. Hammer the teachers if the pupils in this part of Glasgow don't have the same, you know, results as this other part of Glasgow or the suburb just outside, then it must be the teachers to blame. And that's become a very convenient politician's argument. And finally, looking at, you know, what it is that some schools have been able to do to make a difference. It's never absolute, but relatively speaking, to give this bunch of kids a better chance in life. Yeah.
And the book's kind of infused with kind of stories or kind of nuggets about kind of experiences, and you know, you were saying about what does it actually look like? What does it mean to be a young person in poverty? So that must have been quite challenging to kind of include that in the book.
Yeah, some of the there hasn't actually been a lot of work about what it actually feels like, and there's hardly anything. I don't think anybody's really taken seriously in the sort of bile that's come from the present Westminster government about you know, people on benefits, you know, all of the abusive talk about sort of lifestyle choice, and really all of this, it must wash over onto children, onto particularly adolescents' consciousness, and we're behind in terms of this. There's not been any serious research yet about how this impacts on children's consciousness, but we do have recent research that shows, for example, how poverty does affect children. It affects the way they're regarded by others because they can't buy the clothes that the others wear. It stops them going out because they don't want to show themselves. It hinders friendships because they can't afford the bus fares. And all of these things, even we've got evidence from interviews that they stop, that they won't tell parents that there's a school trip on because they know this would cause an embarrassment. So there's massive issues of sort of self-esteem, this impact on children. Secondly, I think there's been... I mean, my friend and colleague, another Australian who was here in Scotland for a while, Bob Lingard, advised me before starting this book, look first at the sociology. And I think it was really good advice. But we're actually in a situation where there are not very many studies of close-up, you know, through interviews, observation and so on, of what poverty in Britain after Thatcher, let alone in the under the coalition, what it actually looks like and feels like. And I was very lucky to come across a book by a guy called Simon Charlesworth, who did tons of interviews in the Doncaster, Rotherham, South Yorkshire area. And out of that, I came to the conclusion that the two dominant features of the psychology of living in poverty. One, there's an overwhelming sense of shame, of low self-esteem, sometimes expressing itself as anger, a sort of blind anger. But the other one's a sense of sort of futility, that whatever you do doesn't really work out. You know, you can save up a bit of money for a holiday, but then the electricity bill comes in. And you know, you can go on a training course, and it doesn't lead to anywhere. And now, both of these things, I don't think we've taken seriously enough how they affect children in schools. But we do know that even those children who are doing well at age 11 or 12 tend to fall behind. Three quarters of them fall behind by age 16. So there is something very serious going on in the consciousness of a young person. And we really have to pay much closer attention to that. So it's, I think that's just about where we are with it. Yeah, there are some really, really good quotes from Charles. Do you want me to read one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I was at your group launch some time ago, and the quotes were really good.
Okay. Right. They ought to leave you alone if you're studying. Yeah, but you have to show them that you're looking for work to get any money. Yeah, you can't just say you're at college. So in other words, you know, the kid who's trying to get a higher qualification has to interrupt that in order to, you know, get the money to survive. That's been a very common experience. Another one, it relates to one particular batch of employment training schemes. My son, they've made him go on these training schemes. It's just cheap labour. They had him training to be a welder, and then he were back on dole. Then they had him doing joinery, and then he were back on dole again. Now they've got him doing forklift truck driving. So I guess next he'll be an unemployed forklift truck driver. So it's in school we're expecting pupils to look at the long term, and I've been in many S2 classes which have been where there's been an attempt to motivate the kids by saying in 3 years time you'll be doing your standard grades and after that and after that. This is really, really very difficult to look in the long term if you're surrounded by other young people who are stuck. So I think it's some serious thinking here.
What difference does poverty make to achieving this, if you're one of the core themes here? I'm interested more in that kind of question, but is there anything from, you've kind of talked about how politicians have painted certain sectors of society over the years, but does the academic literature go back to enlighten us at all about historically how poverty has made a difference to achievement?
I think the difficult thing is that there have been lots of false arguments that have held sway for a long time. I mean, from around 1910, 1920, up to the 1960s, it was very widely believed that intelligence was genetically transmitted. And it was only really when finally Cyril Burt's twins research was exposed as fraudulent that the bubble of that burst. So you've had an academic trend that's actually been quite misleading, and it's quite embarrassing to say that. Interestingly enough, although the theory has been punctured, I think we still have the practices of that. We have the survival of that. I mean, there are many primary one classes in Scotland where the children within a month are divided up according to ability, when what we actually mean is that they've had different life experiences up to the age of six. These misleading theories can can last rather a long time. There's still the notion around since Bernstein's very messy research, which was exposed in the early 70s as misleading and ill-founded, that working-class families, and now people talk about sort of poorer families, don't talk to their children properly, they neglect them, and all the rest of it. I mean, Bernstein's version was that manual workers only talk to the children about what they can actually see in front of them. Such a lot of nonsense. And we do have modern data that shows that children of more educated parents acquire a higher vocabulary by the age of five. But there is the data suggests that only a very small portion, even of the poorest fifth of the population, actually have serious limitations of language when they enter school. You know, they're almost all fully capable of progressing in school. So there's misleading work, and I think just about the most damaging, perhaps, is the present argument about aspirations. Some of the research we looked at, the researchers had taken at face value when they'd interviewed, let's say, a head teacher looking from their office saying what Mrs. Jones across the other end of the playground thinks and feels. And the real question, well, how do they know this? You know, is this telepathy?
Yeah.
You know, they just don't care. They're just content that their children will be on the dole and all the rest of it. And these opinions get recycled. So I think we're battling against quite a lot of prejudice that gets recycled. I mean, one of the most interesting things I found about aspirations is there's a lovely quote here. It comes from a piece of research sponsored by Joseph Rowntree. What might look like low aspirations may actually be high aspirations that have been eroded by negative experience. Now, the other really helpful thing was a university researcher, Jessica Bock, who's another part of the Queensland connection, I guess. She wrote... she's writing about aspirations, and she's saying not just that you need opportunities to sustain aspirations, they can't just sort of continue in the air, but she's also saying that a lot of parents don't know the route map, they don't know how to advise the children, they don't know how to interpret what the school is saying, and if you're the first in the family, you know, to have a chance to go to university, it's quite different from having people who've made that trip before.
Yeah.
So I think this notion of a route map, you know, is. She also talks about. She said it's like improvising a play without a script. Yeah, and you've only got one chance. So some important stuff, you know, pursued by academics over the generations. And also some seriously misleading stuff, and one of our jobs has been to try to sort that out.
I will say at this point, I know we've got about 10-15 minutes of the show to go. If you are listening to the live stream or indeed the podcast, any time after, then you can get in touch in two ways. If you're on Twitter, you can pop something up and include the hashtag EduTalk. Or you can email edutalker, that's edutalkr at hotmail.co.uk. Just moving on, or maybe even back, let's tell you, maybe I should have asked this earlier on, but the politicians and sociologists, etc., the political theorists, you know, can we just touch on the kind of range of explanations that are given for why poverty exists? Or has existed or continues to exist frustratingly in this day and age.
Why poverty still exists? Yeah. Well, I think it's very interesting that we're actually seeing a resurgence of the genetic argument. I mean, there's a team of researchers in London that the present Westminster government, and particularly Michael Gove, have latched onto. And this provides, you know, the answer to all of their questions. Because if you can, I mean, it's become very evident that we're in a situation where it's austerity for most, and even more wealth for some. The very richest have made a bomb out of the austerity politics of the last few years since the bank collapse. And so, if they can present an argument that it's actually futile to continue running sure start schemes and so on, because it's all genetic, then that is very convenient and it lets them off the hook. And it's quite interesting, right from the very beginning, you know, some of the earliest people pushing this genetic intelligence idea, they were very politically conscious about what they were doing. And they said it's just people are in their place and it justifies that. You know, justifies social divisions because people are rich because they're cleverer.
You also write about kind of the ongoing battle between, you know, capital and labour and such like.
Yeah.
Is that something that you came to a conclusion is still relevant?
I think it's highly relevant. I mean, obviously there are differences, whether if you're a teacher or if you're doing various types of uncertain part-time, low-skilled, low-paid work. There are differences in consciousness and lifestyle and everything, and you can't neglect that. It's very, very important. But I think the way the whole society is controlled by a very small number of people who sit outside of that actually own and control most of the wealth of the world, and certainly of Scotland. Certainly is true in Scotland. So yes, I think that in itself creates a lot of confusion, so we do tackle that in the argument. I think it's become very convenient in the last 20 years to blame schools. And the strange thing is that I remember Mike Rosen, the children's poet, standing up at a conference and saying, you know, they're the same politicians now. And again, I think we're talking about Westminster. But that still does control a lot of our lives. So that same government are saying it's the genes, it's the parents' fault, etc. But they're also saying it's the teachers to blame. Now you'd think there'd be a contradiction there, but no. So they're really quite abusive towards teachers who are working in the areas of greatest need. Now that's not in the slightest to say that we can be complacent, and there are things that teachers can do, but I think the blame game is absolutely futile.
I mean, and we'll actually take a short break at the moment, but just before we come on, maybe to talk more about what teachers and schools can and indeed are doing. You've spoken about the politicians are playing the blame game, but do you and your co-writer shift the blame elsewhere? Do you feel it's your role to actually say, well, the blame shouldn't be here, it should be there, or do you find that the whole idea of blame is actually not productive?
We came to the conclusion, I think, that first of all, there is an economic foundation to all of this, that you cannot get rid of the impact of poverty unless you get rid of poverty, unless we live in a more equal society. That is absolutely fundamental. Secondly, though, I think we found that the sort of controls that, and again, I must stress that this is an international picture, Australia, the USA, England, which doesn't affect Scotland as much, where politicians are rather more cautious. But there is a tendency to think that if you tighten the screws a bit more on schools, if you dictate to teachers how they teach, that's actually going to help the poorest children. And what it actually seems to do, from the international evidence here, is it narrows down what children are offered. So there's a very useful term that an American coined. He talks about the pedagogies of poverty. And the late Jean Anion, unfortunately, very sadly, died earlier this year, middle of last year. Jean Anion compared schools in different areas and looked at the very different curriculum on the ground, you know, the children were subject to, and the less chance, you know, there was more routine learning, more accumulation of facts, more restricted opportunities to get engaged in an argument and a debate and all the rest of it. So there was more rote learning, more copying out, even basic things like that, in the poorer areas. So that's, I think we would blame politicians who think they know better and actually impose substandard curricula.
Just reminded of our conversation with Craig Wigley on his new book, Living on the Edge, Rethinking Poverty, Class and Schooling. Just before we go on to the last couple of questions, Terry, maybe say a bit about the response so far to the book. Have there been criticisms, challenges that you've taken up? Understand that the book's formed the basis of a master's course in England, and also like to hear from you, your thoughts on why practitioners should be engaging with the one or more of the chapters.
We've had some really great reviews. That's the first thing, but I think by the way of things, they've tended to be from academics. They've not all been from academics. Teachers in schools don't often sit down to write reviews. Hope people listening do get hold of the book, do read it. I think it's important for two reasons. One is that it's important to be wise to the false arguments. As I said at the beginning, the arguments are still current that some children are just low ability. I'm talking my 11 years in teaching PGDE and B.Ed courses, a number of times that students are just presented as common sense. Well, you have your bright pupils and you have your not very able pupils. You know, without any questioning, where does this come from? What do you mean? You know, here. This idea of fixed intelligence, this idea of parents who just don't give a damn, this idea of kids who really don't care, the idea of children who are unteachable because they arrive at school unable to speak. Well, there are not very many of those. I think it is really, really important to be able to be thoughtful about those arguments and not simply swallow them, because they can get swallowed up and you can flow along with them in a sort of staff room gossip. I think we're all familiar that sort of chat that damns everybody who lives on that street or the whole family because we had Darren, 5 years ago. We know what Wayne's going to be like, don't we? Or that mother can't be any good because she's got three children and she's not married. Now, if this was a teacher, they'd say, oh, how wonderful, because isn't it great? She's a single parent and she's really managing wonderfully. So, I mean, staff rooms tend to be places of prejudice, so I think it's really important to be able to think beyond that and challenge it. I think the second thing is that there are classroom challenges here. As I was mentioning before, the break, there's been this tendency, I think, very well documented in the USA, more than anywhere, where teachers in the most challenging areas lowering their expectations and saying, well, we can't teach this because the children's literacy isn't very good. And I think that's the real challenge. How to I think it's fatal if you get a school just putting children through literacy exercises and everything dries up. I think you've got to deal with those, and this goes beyond the individual teacher. I think schools have got to deal with the skills issues, but they've also, and at the same time, got to present a challenging curriculum, one that gets children to think and think about the real world that they're living in, including their own lives.
And then that criticism for literacy programmes would be if there's cultural or class norms there that the young people don't value or can't access because of maybe a different language that they would use at home. Is that right? So the targets are the wrong, you could argue the wrong targets.
Yeah, I think we've got to ask basic questions like what does literacy mean, and it's also about voice. It's about agency. It's not just about neat copying with the right punctuation. Although that's not you can't neglect that sort of thing, but it's. I think that's the crunch of it, that how do we create an experience in schools, and some schools clearly do it, where everybody feels that they belong, that they're valued here, where I first started my writing about 11 years ago looking at schools, inner city schools, where the vast majority of pupils were had families that didn't speak English at all, mainly Pakistani and Bangladeshi pupils. And I was looking deliberately at more successful schools, and these were features that came out very strongly. The kids had a sense of their own worth in all sorts of ways through the school. The senior staff in particular had very close links with the community. But there was also something about the learning. And the way I'd sum this up now, a lot of school learning, if we don't think about it, if we just run an autopilot, a lot of school learning can be a bit like factory work. Do this because I tell you to, do it for an hour, then I'll collect it in, then you get a sort of wage in the form of a grade, you know? And so it's alienated labour, you know, to use a traditional Marxist concept. And one of the things that characterise these schools, which I believe characterises all schools which are achieving against the odds, is a sense of authentic involvement in work, something worthwhile, some worthwhile inquiry. And it's a sense of what's the outcome going to be? Presentations, performance, products, all of these things. I mean, I know some schools that are really strongly geared towards that. The pupils feel that it's not just about what they might get in 5 years' time. It's about what they can see at the end of these 3 weeks, and they can share and so on. So it's a whole culture of learning that's different. Constant reporting back to the class. This is what we've just been finding out, and so on. So I think there are some real practical challenges. Unfortunately, I think there's a lack of genuine political support to help teachers in areas of the greatest disadvantage learn from each other, research their own practice, and so on. Find out more about the area that they're working, find out what other schools do. I've been working with a group of schools down in Leeds, and we've got a master's degree attached to it, and this all takes time, and the teachers in those schools don't automatically have that time, and so I think it does require a political recognition. I think certainly, I mean, this is the issue that in Scotland constantly falls off the agenda. And you know, there isn't a forum, a network, and maybe we've got to build that, including operating as a pressure group from the bottom up, among teachers, a network of teachers. I know the EIS leadership are very, very interested in this issue. So can we create that sort of network where teachers can learn from each other?
You were saying there about teachers being very busy and needing to help to make a change of
plan. And incredibly so in schools where the teacher's also being a social worker as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many demands on your time.
And in that respect, I was going to ask what's your favourite chapter in the book, but alongside that, which chapter or chapters might a busy teacher who maybe gets a hold of this book someday?
No, I'd say read a chapter a month. read a chapter a month.
Where do you think a teacher should start? Right from the beginning of the book?
I think at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think it is important to have a look at what poverty is doing to children. I think that's crucial, and I think without that, it's very hard to make sense of some of the later bits. I mean, I'd go right back to the beginning. This notion that we got from some of the what's called ethnographic studies. It's that close up study of communities, and Simon Charlesworth's work. It's if adults are affected by a sense of shame, you know, their own status in the present, and affected by a sense of futility about their futures, you know, the rest of their lives, then schools can either reinforce this, you know, by denying respect in various subtle ways, or they can counter that. They can either create a situation where the kid feels it's what's the point of trying? It's already got a label which says bottom stream, I'm the foundie, whatever. Or there's a sense that this work's exciting, and this is what we're going to produce at the end of 2 or 3 weeks. So I think the word culture is misused such a lot, used in shallow ways by the leadership people. And I think, but this is about a culture of learning. How a school contradicts, you know, fights against these really oppressive feelings of life.
Certainly from my reading, as I keep saying, I'm a classroom practitioner myself, but it really got me thinking. It took me back to some reading that I did university courses in years gone by, but that the whole idea that society, I suppose, within their schools can perpetuate inequality just through their own culture.
Yeah. I think if schools are an automatic pilot, then this is what tends to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit then about some of the areas, some of the schools where they are conscious, they have got a conscience, that they're conscious of the need to fight against inequality and to try and alleviate poverty in some way? Can you pick out common features of these particular?
Common features, Well, I think absolutely crucial to get a realistic picture of the area, of the community. I mean, it is again the norm in teaching is that you cut off and you live somewhere away, you know, and your knowledge of this bit of Edinburgh, this bit of Dundee where you're teaching is very largely actually through dramatic encounters with an angry parent. You know, it's very easy after you got worked up, because it's the first time Mrs. McIntosh has ever been into school and she's furious about something, and she might not have a right to be, or she might, but it feels threatening. So the gossip around the staff room is how everybody on that estate is like this, everybody down that street, and they're all heroin addicts, and you know, we know all these things. So and they don't care about the kids and all the rest of it. So I think one of the things we've been doing on our master's course in Leeds, and I'd love to run this out at Scottish University. Any listeners? We asked our teachers to interview some pupils with a set of questions that were positively slanted. Do you know anybody who reads a lot? Do you know anybody with an interesting job? Do you know anybody who's travelled? Anybody who makes anything or grows things? A dangerous one, that. Is there anybody you talk to a lot? Who helps you with your schoolwork? Yeah? And so we found this very, very mixed picture in the same individual. Really serious deprivation. You know, the kid who said, well, I once walked the other side of Asda because I wanted to see what it was like, and after half an hour I realised it was just the same as this side, and they'd never been any further, and they were 15. So real signs of the pressure. But also, you know, in the same pupil, you know, his dad had taught him how to play bass guitar, and his brother worked in, you know, a station in Ryman's stationery shop, but found it a really fascinating job, and, you know, felt they were doing something worthwhile. And all sorts of things like this, that all sorts of positives in children's lives, that if we knew how to tap into, we'd teach them to feel a bit different. So it's that, but it's also about, you know, how to find new ways of teaching and learning that give a real sense of satisfaction to the pupils, and at the same time teach them vital skills. Yeah, so no, it's not. No, don't start at chapter 7 or chapter 3. Read it slowly. But so, read it.
I'm conscious of the time today. Okay. It's been really great having you on the show again, of course.
Yeah. Can I say where they get the book from?
So that's I'm just going to ask you my very final question.
Yeah.
I've got my own copy, and it's enjoying reading through just now, but where can listeners get a hold of Living on the Edge?
Okay, I mean, the quickest way at the moment is probably Book Depository, which is it's a sort of mail order firm, but I think they do pay the taxes, unlike some other companies. You can get it from Amazon as well. There's also bookshops, obviously. You can order it direct from the publishers, who are Peter Lang, although their European base is in Switzerland, but the books do arrive very, very quickly. And if you want a discount copy, I'm entitled to an author's discount, which I can pass on. So if you want to buy a copy for £15 instead of £24, my email is Terry Wrigley, without a full stop in there, TERRYWRIGLEY, like the spearmint, @gmail.com. So I look forward to hearing from you folks.
Thanks very much, Terry, for appearing on Radio Edge Talk this evening, and best wishes for the future.